So we have approached in our congregational reading the end of the fourth gospel. From all evidence, the last to be written and the last that we're reading this year. And the gospels are all written in this manner. There's little said about his beginning, but the three-year period of Jesus' life at the end of his life is what they focus on. But even that three-year record, it's at a fast pace. A lot's happening. Until you get to the last week, and especially to that day before he died. And a large amount of the material in all four Gospels are dedicated to a less than a 24-hour period of his life. So that's telling us something. That the greatest story ever told, we all know that it's a story of things that happen, not a fairy tale. It's what we mean by story. Like a story about George Washington, or a story about somebody who lived in ancient days. That this story, which is the greatest one, that the most vital part of the story is at the end. And over the next three Sundays, we're going to look at that story. So things are a little different, as you can see. But I think this is the way we need to do it. Jesus had been predicting what was going to happen to him for some time. To his apostles, he told them on several occasions with detail how he would be arrested and tried, how he would be beaten and crucified. But when the events unfold, it appears as though they hadn't been listening. But Jesus saw it coming. And what we have in that slowed down part of the Gospels, when the movement is looked upon with great detail, is his path to the cross. And that path, we're going to look at the first juncture of it tonight. This morning, rather. And that is the night that he was arrested and overnight tried. And this starts with Jesus eating the Passover feast with his apostles. The Passover feast, which he had eaten all his life, and so had they. But this one would be different. Because something else was happening in Jerusalem. The chief priests, who were the leaders of the party of the Sadducees, were conspiring with the scribes, the leaders of the Pharisees. And the Sadducees and the Pharisees mix like oil and water. They despised each other in general. The Sadducees were connected to the wealthy, the landed aristocracy, and they worked in conjunction with the priesthood. More on the priesthood later. And if you have sort of a warm feeling about priesthood, regarding the priests we're going to talk about, don't. The Sadducees' focus was on the temple, because there was a lot of activity there that they controlled. There was a lot of market activity that they controlled. And yes, the chief priests and all their connections gained monetarily by the actions around the temple complex. They had an economic investment there. And really, for most of Jesus' ministry, he did not clash that much with the Sadducees until toward the end, when for the second time, but in a more robust manner, he cleansed the temple, condemned the commercial activity in the complex. And now, with his significant following, the Sadducees saw him as a threat. However, the Pharisees and Jesus had never seen eye to eye. Though from a moral standpoint, there were a lot of things they would have had in common. From a religious standpoint, they would have had a lot of things in common. The problem was Jesus condemned them over and over for their traditions because they had taken their oral law, surrounded God's written law with it, and it had smothered it and distorted what true righteousness was. And so Jesus exposed their pseudo-righteousness. And as a result, he constantly clashed with the Pharisees and the scribes. And now the time had come that the chief priests and the scribes are both working to have him killed. When Jesus eats the Passover meal with his disciples, they did what Jewish people did then. They ate the roasted lamb. They dipped the bitter herbs. They ate the unleavened bread. They drank the unfermented fruit of the vine because you didn't have leaven in your house. And as they were reclining at table and eating the Passover feast, Jesus began to speak of things that were transformative. And in the middle of the Passover feast, or at least toward the end of it, he identified the bread and said, "Take, eat, this is my body." He's not referencing something in the past in memorializing the Passover lamb that was sacrificed for the deliverance of the Israelites. He is saying that this is my body. My body that's going to be sacrificed. And he said, "This is regarding the cup, this is my blood. And this is the blood given in a new covenant." So Jesus is indicating that there is change that's coming, but it's linked to the foreshadowing of the Passover. And that he, like the Passover lamb who shed its blood, he was going to offer up his body and his blood was going to be shed for the sake of deliverance. While he's talking about this most sacred thing, other things were happening. Jesus said, "In this supper, one of you will betray me." For you see, the religious leaders were looking for an opportune time where they could, by stealth, arrest Jesus. They wanted to arrest him outside of the crowds. And Judas stole money from the other disciples. He kept the treasury. He was a man that is complex to us, but the bottom line is that he loved money. And whether he wanted to do Jesus in, which doesn't make sense, or whether he thought he's the Messiah, "I can cash in on this," they're not going to harm the Messiah. Jesus will get out of this. He's too powerful. I've seen it. And so Jesus can show his power and I can gain from it. Who knows what's going on in this man's heart exactly? Except that Jesus said that very night, it would have been better if he had never been born. Judas had already plotted with the religious leaders, the chief priests and the scribes, to find an opportune time and place away from the crowds where he could lead their officers to Jesus to arrest him. And that plot was in the works where they were eating the Passover. Also, while Jesus is referencing his sacrifice as the new Lamb of God, the disciples themselves were arguing because they sensed the kingdom of the Lord was about to come about. They were arguing over who was going to be greatest in that kingdom among them. They were jockeying for position. And Jesus verbally taught them that the leader among you needs to be as one who serves. And then as we studied last Sunday morning, he got up from the table. And he got down on his knees. And he washed their feet like a lowly servant and then told them, what I've done for you, you need to do for one another. What a charged setting that was. And when they leave that setting, Jesus begins to tell them something that was, well, to them, unbelievable. We studied this last winter and we looked at the New Testament geography and the layout of Jerusalem. They were most likely in the place where the common folks lived. They were in the southern part of Jerusalem, most likely the southwestern part. And they made their way through the lower part of the city over the Kidron Valley, like a big ravine, up to the Mount of Olives. And as they were going, Jesus told them, you're going to be scattered tonight. The disciples protested, we're not going to leave you. Even Peter said, all else, all others may fail you, but I will not. Peter promised to not leave him, even if it meant imprisonment and even if it meant death. And Peter asked for it. Jesus added an extra prediction for Peter after he told them, Satan's asked to sift you, and I pray that you'll be strengthened. You won't lose your faith, and you'll strengthen your brethren. But he tells him, before the rooster crows twice, you'll deny me three times. When they got to Mount of Olives, they came to a place that was a typical place that Jesus would gather with his disciples outside of Jerusalem. It was a garden called Gethsemane. And Judas knew about it. And Judas had already told, anticipating this, the officers of the Jewish leaders where to find him. And Judas had left the supper early to get them, to lead them to that place. Jesus knew that this was at hand. And he told his disciples, the apostles, the 11 there, my soul is sorrowful, even to death. The way Jesus is described when he is in Gethsemane that night is with language that depicts a human being under the utmost stress and pressure. He asks them to pray. And he leaves the body of the apostles and he takes three, Peter, James, and John, a little further away from the others. And he tells them to watch and pray and then he leaves them. And he goes a distance and he kneels to pray. And he prayed to the Father, if possible, may this cup pass. He's talking about everything that's about to happen, including his death. But he said, but not my will, but yours be done. That doesn't reflect on Jesus' a reluctance to do the Father's will. That doesn't reflect on Jesus' a misunderstanding or a lack of understanding of what his mission was. It reflected how hard it was going to be. How difficult it was going to be. And not just being cursed and rejected and mistreated by humans, but by having the sins of the world placed on him to carry by his own Father. And so he goes back to his disciples and he finds them sleeping. And he asks, can you not watch and pray for 1 hour? He departs and goes back and kneels again and prays the same prayer. He comes back a second time and finds them sleeping. He goes back and prays a third time. This time we're told that he was in agony. And then his sweat became like blood. This is in Luke's account. Now, does that mean in a symbolic way that he was sweating so profusely that it was like he was bleeding? Like you would cut yourself and bleed? Maybe. There's also a rare phenomenon that has been occasionally historically documented where the human body is under so much stress and pressure that blood actually leaks through the blood vessels and comes through the skin. But that's how much pressure he was under. So much that the Father sent an angel to comfort him. And then he came back after praying the prayer three times. And he told the apostles, "Rise, the betrayer is at hand." Jesus knew all things, even those things that had yet to transpire. But even those apostles could look across the Kidron Valley and see, as they came from the official headquarters of the Jewish council and high priest, they could see that band of men coming down the other side of the ravine and up, because they were carrying torches and clubs and swords. And they walked up to Jesus and the 11 apostles. A large band of officers sent from the Jewish leadership, well armed. And they were led by Judas. And Judas walked up to Jesus, because he had told the contingency of soldiers, "The one I kiss is the one." See, that sounds strange to us. In the late 19th century, police departments began to use photographs in the Western world, and it transformed law enforcement, because bad guys tend to do bad things a lot. And so a guy gets arrested and you take his picture. It's called a mugshot. And then you hear somebody else's store is broken into, and so you show the, "Is this the guy?" "Oh yeah, that's the guy." They didn't have that back then. So to identify someone, you had to have confirmation, usually by some witness. And so Judas said, "I'll tell you the one by the one I kiss." And he walked up to Jesus, and the kiss was the Near Eastern demonstration of affection. You know, we shake hands, that's formal. In the Near East, in ancient times, they bowed, as the Far East does today. But in the Near East, in the ancient world, they kissed on the side of the face like we hug. And he kissed Jesus, and he said, "Rabbi." And Jesus looked at him and said, "Judas, do you betray the Son of Man with a kiss?" And then Jesus took the lead. And he said, "Who do you seek?" Someone from this contingency said, "Jesus of Nazareth." And Jesus said, "I am he." An interesting thing happens. These Jewish soldiers, officers sent from the leadership, fall back. It's an unusual thing. This is found in the Gospel of John, which consistently talks about Jesus saying, "I am the light, I am the shepherd, I am the way, the truth, and the life," which was pulling from that Exodus statement when Moses was told, when he asked, "Who do I say sent me?" The "I am" sent you, which means self-existent one. It's an expression for one who is eternal, for God. And Jesus uses it. Jesus was not doing the things he was doing under a rock. Everybody around this area, especially in the Jewish community, knew about him and things he was doing. And so when he claims this, it just sort of takes them back. And then he asks again, "Who do you seek?" And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." And he said, "I am he." And they seize him. And when they seize him, Peter had a sword and he drew it. And he went after one of these men who happened to be a servant of the high priest, and he cut off his ear. And we all know that was probably not his intent. I mean, that's what you do, right? You defend your friend. That's what you do, right? The Messiah is the triumphant conqueror. I'll pull my sword and he'll wipe them all out. That's not what happens. It was Peter who got the rebuke. And he was told that he should put his sword away. And he said, depending on your translation, either permit this or suffer this, or he said, no more of this. Stop this. Let this happen. And he warned Peter, if you live by the sword, you will perish by the sword. And he actually told the group, let these others go. And they do. And they fled. And they seized Jesus and they carried him off. Jesus first goes to a man whose name was Annas. He was the former high priest. He was the older statesman. He had been high priest 15 years before. Now, the priesthood. We tend to want to think that they were these holy men who led the Israelites in worship. That was their technical role. But the leaders in the priesthood, not all of them, not the rank and file, but the leaders, the chief priests, they were corrupt. They were raking money from the temple activities and putting it in their pockets. They were political operatives all the way. They were the ones that were either courting Roman favor or being a thorn in their side. They were the ones who had the local power granted to them by the Romans, and they threw it around to their own benefit. And oftentimes, the chief priest, by this point in the early first century, the Romans were tired of the Jews trying to work out who should be the chief priest, and the Romans wanted some leverage. The Romans actually would appoint the chief priest. Do you understand that? The Romans appointed who was chief priest. So guess what would happen sometimes? A chief priest would be appointed. And you know, if you scratch my back, I scratch yours. That's how all politics work. Every form of political activity, it all works that way. This chief priest would come to office. He would start filling his pocket. And he would give a kickback to certain Roman authorities for picking him to be the chief priest. And then if that chief priest did something that the Romans didn't like, they'd get rid of him. So Annas had been removed 15 years before. He had a couple of sons who had been priests. There had been like four priests since Annas was a priest, a high priest, since Annas was a priest. And the one now was his son-in-law, a man named Caiaphas. We'll get to him. But Annas still had influence. And he is still called the chief priest, much like people call George Bush President Bush and Bill Clinton President Clinton today, though neither one of them were presidents. But you extend them that courtesy. And Annas was one of the power brokers. And so they bring Jesus to Annas first. And this is like an arraignment. This is methodical how they're doing this. We're going to bring him to the elder statesman, anticipating he's going to condemn him. And this will be just another point of leverage to do Jesus in. There appears to be some kind of complex by which Annas and the current chief priests were working, and the chief priest, the high priest, Caiaphas. They all appear to be working out of the same large complex there in Jerusalem. And late that night, this is like what we would call Thursday night, they bring Jesus into there for Annas to examine him. And what Annas asked him about specifically was his teaching and his disciples. What have you been teaching? And tell us about your following. And Jesus eventually responded to him. And what Jesus said to him was, I've been teaching publicly. I've been teaching in the synagogues. I've been teaching in the temple. People have heard me teach. I've been teaching out in the open. In other words, his teaching is nothing that's been secretive. And one of the officers assisting the high priest, keeping Jesus in custody, saw this as an affront. And he slapped him right across the face. Note that there are two kinds of blows that Jesus will receive. Sometimes with the open palm, he is slapped across the face, which is usually intended to be a reactionary insult. How dare you do that? And later we'll see the pounding, the buffeting, which is intended to be a purposeful infliction of pain with the greatest force. But the officer slaps Jesus and says, "You speak to the high priest that way?" And Jesus asks, "If I've done a wrong, but why do you strike me? Why do you strike me?" He puts the question to them. Jesus had done nothing wrong. Something else was happening at this same time. Jesus said that the apostles would all scatter. And they did. But one followed. He was known to the high priest circle. And he gets access into the courtyard. He's not named. But when you put all the little pieces together, it sure does look like John. And then another apostle followed. And he was trying to get entrance into the courtyard. And he is identified in all the texts. It's Peter. And because this other disciple was known to this inner circle, he gets Peter access. And there was a servant girl who was acting as porter. She was keeping the gate. And when Peter walked in, she looked at him. And in the middle of this court area where the servants were hanging out, they built a fire. And when Peter got near the fire and sat down at the fire, because then you can see him better, because it's night, she said, "You're one of his disciples also." Also. You see, the servants knew that this other man was his disciple, John. John was making no, attempt to hide that. And she says, "You're one of his disciples also." And Peter said, "I don't know him." That's one. Because Anna sees sufficient evidence in his own mind, mostly, to condemn Jesus. Jesus is then led to Caiaphas, his son-in-law, which is the current high priest appointed by the Romans. And Caiaphas had formed a quorum of the council. The council, or the Sanhedrin council, was a group of 70 Jewish leaders made up mostly of Sadducees and chief priests with a small representation of Pharisees and scribes. And they were the ones who were supposed to rule the Jews locally for the Romans. And you had to have so many in attendance, it's common in any legislative judicial body, so many in attendance to have an official proceeding. But their own laws had prohibited that at night. They had one. This is now getting up into the early hours of Friday morning. And a quorum of the Sanhedrin met with Caiaphas heading it up. It was accelerating. This was more like a formal trial. This is where they could justify asking for his death. And so they bring in witnesses. This is not just merely Annas examining him. Now this is official. They've got witnesses. But they paraded witness after witness after witness. And the text tells us they were false witnesses. And even their testimony didn't agree. And there was one that's highlighted. One witness said, "I heard him say, 'Destroy the temple of God and I will rebuild it in 3 days.'" It's not what Jesus said. John 2 tells us what he said. He's in the temple complex. He's cleansed it for the first time. What Jesus said was, "Destroy this temple," implying you destroy it. "If it's destroyed, and I will rebuild it in 3 days." However, what he was really talking about was the temple of his body, which was the true temple of God. But they twist his words. And this false witness accuses him of threatening to destroy the temple. And you can imagine how the chief priests and the Sadducees responded to that. And what's remarkable in this phase of the trial, that in a way frustrated these Jewish leaders, is that Jesus wouldn't answer them. He was silent. Like a sheep led to the slaughter. While this second trial was going on with Caiaphas and a cohort or a quorum of the council, Peter is still out in the courtyard. And this time another servant girl walks up and she's got some other people with her and she says, "Aren't you one of his disciples?" The first time Jesus denied, a rooster crowed. The second time he denied knowing Jesus, silent. And we're told in the Gospels, the little details, we're told that an hour passed. An hour. Peter is milling about in this courtyard with all these servants trying to hide out. Incognito. He can't not be there, but he can't be there. An hour later, a larger group walks up, including a relative of Malchus. Malchus was that high priest servant whose ear Peter cut off. Whose ear Jesus restored in the garden. He restores the high priest's servant's ear who had been sent to arrest him, and he rebukes Peter. So this was a notable event to Malchus. And his relative, who was among these servants, said, "You were in the garden. And we know you're a Galilean because your speech betrays you." If you've ever lived somewhere where you had a distinct speech, people know it. I had to learn to talk all over again when I went off to college because nobody understood me. And I was somewhere a couple of nights ago and I heard somebody speak with an English accent. And it's caught my attention, among all these people talking in this crowd. Evidently, Galileans had a certain accent. And they knew he was a Galilean. So he's a Galilean. He's hanging out in this courtyard. He's been brought in by this other disciple of Jesus. And some of us think he was in the garden. You've got to be one of his disciples. And so Peter. And this is what we do when we dig a hole, right? We just what? Keep digging. Peter said, "I don't know the man." And he invoked a curse on himself. Now, we read this, cursing and swearing, and we think modern-day cursing and swearing. He used bad words. No, he invoked a curse on himself. That if I'm not telling the truth, I'll be cursed. And he swore He was telling the truth. And we don't know exactly the logistics of this, but with Peter in the courtyard, surrounded by these buildings with doors and windows, either Jesus looked out of one of them, or Jesus was being taken to another part of this complex, and they were walking him by. Somehow, right when Peter denied him the third time, and the rooster crowed the second time, he looked up and he saw Jesus, and Jesus looked at him. That's all we're told that Jesus looked at. And that's when he left the courtyard. He went out and he wept bitterly. So what happens to Jesus? It's dawn now. And because it's daylight, they can make it official, their condemnation. And so they gather the whole council together. Which is interesting because later on we're told that not everybody was there consenting to this, like Joseph. But they had a large number of the council together at dawn, and they bring Jesus back in and basically repeat that trial. And finally, at a certain point, the high priest asked Jesus, "Tell us, are you the Christ?" And he said, and he rarely did this, he did it privately to the woman at the well, but he tells them, "I am. And you will see the Son of Man at the right hand of the power of God coming on the clouds." We made the point in the class this morning about how a lot of people were not comprehending that the Messiah would be the Son of God, but that Jesus paired them. And this is what had really put so many people over the edge about Jesus, that he was claiming to be equal with the Father. He was claiming to be one with God. He was claiming to be the Son of God. And the high priest shouted out, "Are you the Son of God?" And Jesus said, "You say that I am." Is that a confession? Probably. Jesus was not shy to admit who he was, but he was strategic in what he said. But when he says, "You say that I am," that's the second time Caiaphas unwittingly admits to something. Because we saw this morning in the class in John 11, when he's plotting with his partners to kill Jesus, we're told in the text that when he said, "It's better for one man to suffer than the whole nation suffer," that was actually a prophecy that he did not intend to make because he didn't understand it, that yes, Jesus would be sacrificed for everyone, not just the Israelite nation, but for all of God's people he would call. And here, Caiaphas says, "Are you the Son of God?" And he says, "You say that I am." Caiaphas, in a way, Jesus is saying, "You have confirmed that I am the Son of God." And the high priest tore his garments and said, "What further need do we have of testimony?" And the council voted to condemn him to death. But there's a point here. Technically, the Jewish Sanhedrin Council didn't have the authority of capital punishment. The Romans reserved that. And it would be to their political expediency also to use the Romans to do that. And that was their plan. But before they shuttle Jesus to the governor from Rome, the soldiers who have been watching all this, these Jewish officers, decided to have their own way with him. Jesus was bound, evidently, the whole time. And so they pulled him to the side and they began to humiliate him. They spat on him. They slapped him across the face. And then they took their fists and they punched him over and over. And if that wasn't enough, because they saw him as a joke, claiming to be the Messiah, they covered his face, and when they would hit him, they would say, "Prophesy, who was it that hit you?" Jesus remained silent. Now, you and I know what Jesus could have done. He could have called the name of that man. He could have called the name of his mother and his father and his little brother. He could have described the house he lived in. He could have described what he had for breakfast that morning. But Jesus doesn't. Just like in the garden, when Peter pulled the sword and he told him to put it up, he said, "Don't you know that I could call upon the Father and he would send 12 legions of angels?" He says, really, over 12 legions. 12 legions is roughly 72,000. One angel in the Old Testament wiped out a big part of Israel. One angel went through the land of Egypt and wiped out all the firstborn outside of the Israelites. Over 72,000 angels? That was at Jesus' disposal. But he didn't use it. And he didn't speak to these men who were taunting him to prophesy. The one who had perfect knowledge of all things past, all things present, and all things future. That's what they did to Jesus. And then they led him, bound to Pilate. But as they took him to Pilate, in the Jewish dimension of Jesus' trials came to an end. The Gospels tell us of that apostle who had betrayed him. When Judas saw that Jesus was condemned, it wasn't going the way he thought it was going to go. He had remorse. And he took the 30 pieces of silver that they'd paid him back to the Jewish leadership. And he was returning it. And they told him, "What does that have to do with us?" Do you see? What great friends they were. They'd used Judas. They didn't care about him. They didn't care he was trying to make something right. And so with this cold response, Jesus admits, "I betrayed innocent blood." And he threw down the 30 pieces of silver and he left. And he went out and he hung himself. And thus was the end of Judas. Jewish leaders took the silver because it was blood money, they admitted, and bought a field to bury poor travelers in. And it got the nickname Field of Blood. And so they brought him to Pilate. Pilate is an interesting character. And from all indication, he is your typical Roman political operative. He got where he got because of connections. He got where he got because he carried out the Roman authorities' bidding. And he got where he got because he could sniff a political threat 10 miles away. We think these bears are good at sniffing things out around here. Pilate knew a threat to Rome when he saw it. And Pilate had a very checkered history with the Jewish leadership. He'd been the governor of Judea and Samaria for some time. Herod's kingdom had been broken up after Herod the Great died, and part of it was led by his descendants and relatives, and part of it was governed by Roman-appointed governors, and Pilate was over Judea and Samaria, the real hotbed of Palestine. And Pilate had clashed with the Jewish leaders on many of occasions. There were a lot of accommodations the Romans made to the Jews, not to offend their local sensitivities, especially their customs and their religion and worship. Pilate had some banners carried in at night in Jerusalem that had an insignia on it that offended the Jewish leaders and claimed that that was idolatrous. And Rome made Pilate remove them, sort of embarrassed Pilate. Later on, Pilate had hung in his headquarters, more on that headquarters in a moment, he had hung in those headquarters also some shields that reflected the emperor and honored the emperor. And the Jewish leaders complained about that as being a form of idolatry, and the Roman emperor made him remove those and put them in another headquarters outside of Judea. Again, Pilate was slapped across the wrist. But Pilate could dish it out too. When Pilate got word of a possible insurrection that was fomenting in the temple complex, Pilate had formed a band of assassins who were dressed to look like Jews who carried daggers under their cloaks. And they infiltrated the crowd, and at a signal, they pulled their daggers and started slaying people, and it was a bloodbath. Though we have trouble in the secular history, the gospel accounts tell us that Pilate had mingled the blood of some Galileans with their sacrifices. So there was another occasion where Pilate used violence against Jews. There was no love lost between Pilate and the Jewish leaders. And here they came, shortly after dawn, with Jesus in tow. And when they approached Pilate, they did not enter his headquarters because it was still this holy season, this Passover. And they believed that it would have violated their purity for the Passover if they stepped into his quarters. And so he was required to come out to meet them. How do you think a Roman governor would like that? And so he encounters outside his headquarters the Jewish leadership, mostly Caiaphas, and there's Jesus tied up there. And they begin to fling accusations at him and said, "We found this man guilty of evil. You need to punish him." And Pilate asked, "What has he done?" And this was their reply at first. "Well, if he hadn't done evil, we wouldn't bring him to you. Like, just trust us. You should kill him." Pilate's no pushover. And so they bring three accusations against Jesus. By the way, none of these accusations came up in the trial with Annas and the trial with Caiaphas and the trial before the whole Sanhedrin. None of them. One was, he is misleading the nation. Two, he's forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar. Like they're worried about that. They hated those taxes. And third of all, he claims to be a king. And as they accuse Jesus says nothing. No defense. So Pilate sees the situation. He decides to extract Jesus from his accusers. And so he brings Jesus into the headquarters. Because you see, nothing can defile Jesus. No matter where he steps and who he touches, nothing defiles him. He is that pure. And so Pilate privately interrogates Jesus. And he asks him, "Are you a king?" And Jesus actually converses with Pilate. And he says, "Has Do you think this, or has this been told to you? And Pilate says, am I a Jew? There's a lot in that. The Romans despised the Jews. They thought they were weird and weak. They had one God. They had funny rituals and eating habits. They're just pathetic and strange. And so Pilate saying, am I a Jew? That's the last thing Pilate would want to be. And he says, the chief priests have delivered you up to me. Are you a king? And Jesus told him, you rightly say, but my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom was of this world, my servants would fight and I would not be delivered to the Jews. That, to Pilate, was critical. Because here's Jesus, who's never been known to go walk around calling for armed resistance, never been seen with a sword. When he's arrested, he's got 11 followers. And among them, they had two swords. And he tells them not to put up a fight. All the evidence indicates he is not an insurrectionist. And that logic, my servants would be fighting so I wouldn't be delivered, was backed up by the facts. But Jesus says, my kingdom is not of this world. Which is so instructive and revealing. He's a completely different kind of king. And then he says, so you're a king. And he says, this is the reason I was brought into this world, to bear witness of the truth. Well, which is it? You were brought into this world and born into this world to be king, or bear witness of the truth? Well, the truth is both. So Jesus is admitting he's king, and also his mission. And this statement appeared to just bounce off Pilate like a BB off a brick wall. Pilate is your typical Roman. He's pragmatic. He's carnal. He's fleshly. It's all about what works. It's all about what advances you. And he replies back, what is truth? Now, anybody else that would ask Jesus what is truth with sincerity, seeking to know what is truth, they'd have gotten an answer. But that's not what Pilate is doing. What is truth? It's nothing to him. And so he takes Jesus back to the Jewish leadership. And he says, I find no fault in him. He knew this man was not a political threat to Rome. And he says, I'm going to release him. And he mentions that this was customary at the Passover. There's a custom to release one prisoner among the Jews. I'll just release him and let him go. The Jewish leaders saw this as possibly slipping out of their hands, and they get desperate. And they said, he has stirred up the people all the way from Galilee to Judea. And Pilate heard that word, Galilee. You see, Pilate wasn't governor over Galilee. That was ruled by Herod Antipas. Herod Antipas was a son of Herod the Great. Herod the Great, who had sought to kill Jesus after his birth. Herod the Great was one of the most despicable, violent rulers in that part of the world. But he was good at ruling. And the Romans loved him and gave him a wide berth and let him rule over a large territory in Palestine. Then when he died, they divided it up among different governors at different times or different members of his family. And they were not nearly as effective as Herod. But his son was currently ruling, Herod Antipas, over Galilee. And this is the Herod that John the Baptist had condemned for his marriage. And this is the Herod that had John the Baptist beheaded. This is the Herod, we're told, that had threatened to kill Jesus when he heard about Jesus' teaching and miracle working and the crowds following him. And one of the few occasions when Jesus got really sharp with his words, he said, "Go tell that fox." He called Herod a fox. "Go tell that fox that I cast out demons and do many miracles." It's pretty bold. But they'd never met until that day. And Pilate saw an opportunity. If I send this Jesus over to Herod, first of all, I can dodge this complicated situation. And second of all, Herod's going to want this. And this will build goodwill with Herod. Because you see, the Herodian rulers resented the governors of Rome because they thought they should be ruling those areas. So they didn't get along. And Herod, Antipas, and Pilate did not get along. But Herod was in town because of the Passover, because the Herodian rulers pretended to be Jewish, though they were very despicable people in their moral life. So he was there to celebrate the Passover. And what was interesting is that Pilate was in the Herodian palace, which was an ornate, fancy house that he ruled from when he was in Jerusalem. But Antipas, his father, had built it. But when Herod Antipas was in town, he had to be somewhere else. And so this was a gesture of goodwill. And so Jesus comes to Herod. Herod was excited because he wanted to see Jesus do some kind of sign, like Jesus was a carnival act. And the chief priests and the scribes came with their accusations, and they let Jesus have it in front of Herod. Think about it. They're getting nowhere with Pilate. But Herod knows their customs. Herod knows about the Jewish temple. They've got leverage with Herod to see how that Jesus is a problem. And he has got some influence with the Roman authorities. So maybe they can go the Herod route and have Jesus done in. And that's why they blister Jesus with accusations. And Jesus says nothing. Matter of fact, the whole time he's in the company of Herod, Jesus never uttered a word. And then Herod asks him a lot of questions. Jesus has no reply. And then he allows his soldiers to take a fancy garment and wrap it around Jesus and to mock him, indicating that he's some ruler and they're pretending to honor him. And he just sends him back. Jesus ends up being pretty boring to Herod. And he sends him back with the word, "I find no fault in him." And so Pilate says again to the Jewish delegation here of leaders, "I did not find any guilt in him. Herod found no guilt in him. I'm going to let him go." But there's a problem here for Pilate. Pilate sees that Jesus is not a political threat, but those Jewish leaders were. Because if those Jewish leaders complained enough to the emperor, if they slung enough mud about Pilate, it would stick. And we know this because just a few years later, the Samaritans complain about him and he's removed. And so Pilate is trying to walk a tightrope. He doesn't see a reason to have this man put to death, but at the same time, he does not want to rile up the Jewish leaders. And so he comes up with a solution. He says, "I'll punish him and release him." And what he meant by that was that he was going to have him scourged or flogged. If you were a Roman citizen and you were sentenced to be whipped, they used like a long reed, like a big switch. But for non-citizens, and especially for slaves, if the Romans were going to punish you, they used a scourge. Had a wooden handle about this long, like a nightstick. And then attached to it were leather strips or thongs. And embedded in the leather strips were bits of either metal, bone, or stone. Oftentimes, scourging or flogging was a punishment in and of itself. Occasionally, one would be scourged before crucified. But Pilate intends to scourge him, thinking that will be enough. It was not uncommon for someone to pass out and die after being scourged. Because it is, among all types of beatings in the annals of history, is one of the worst you can read about. They would begin to hit the person after stripping them of their clothes on the back. Usually done on the back, occasionally they would deliver some blows to the chest and stomach. But those straps of leather would whip around the shoulders and the sides, the neck, even the face. And at first it would put welts on the skin, stripes on the skin. But then with each following blow, it would dig deeper and deeper until the skin became like ribbons. And then with more and more blows, the flesh under the skin became like hamburger. And on some occasion, they were whipped so much and so much damage done that occasionally a vital organ could be seen through the flesh. They were strapped to a rock and beaten this way. That wasn't enough. As the soldiers are taking him back to Pilate, at Pilate's order to have him flogged, they decide to do something. Tacitus, the great Roman historian, writes about this. And there's a Latin phrase, but I'm not going to try it. But the Latin phrase, literally the words are these: also perishing added humiliation. In other words, in addition to perishing, you add humiliation. They thought this man probably would eventually be executed, and they were right. So they did this little practice they had. I mean, these Roman soldiers, these are not like modern professional soldiers. Some of these were incredible soldiers, but they were rough. They were a rough lot. And before they take him back to Pilate, after being flogged, he's just barely walking, they call the whole battalion out. And they find an old purple robe worn by a ruler. And they put it on Jesus, on that back that's been beaten. And then they take thorns. I know we see pictures of these really neat and clean, perfectly encircled thrones, you know, for a crown. No, that's not what happens with thorns. I mean, thorns are sticking everywhere. It's hard to control them. They take a batch of thorns and they make a crown out of it and put it on his head. And then, evidently, they gave him a reed for a scepter. And they began to shout to him, "Hail!" That's what you said to Caesar. "Hail Caesar! Hail, King of the Jews!" And they took the reed and they beat him over the head with it. And they took their open hand, and to the one that they were mocking and bowing to, they slapped him across the face. After all he'd been through, then they do that. And then they take him back to Pilate. Pilate was on the hot seat in more ways than one, because word had been sent from his wife, "Don't have anything to do with this righteous man, for I have suffered many things of him in a dream." Romans were very superstitious, by the way, people. Pilate takes Jesus. By this time at his headquarters, not only was the Jewish leadership there, but a crowd was there, Jewish people from the city. And he brings Jesus out wearing the purple robe and the crown of thorns. And he says, "Behold the man." Pilate thought that would satisfy them. It doesn't. Not at all. Because they're spurred on now by the chief priests. Because though they thought at the beginning of the week this was the Messiah, there's no way the Messiah would be beaten and humiliated and mocked and made fun of and slapped around. There's no way this is the Messiah. And so you know how people do with their heroes. They turn and they turn. And they don't want him released. And Pilate sees something in this whole operation. He sees that they've really delivered him up because they're envious of him. And Pilate tells them, "Do you want to release to you this king, your king?" And they cry out, "Crucify him." And then they yell something that scares Pilate. They say, "He's claiming to be the Son of God." And John's text tells us that made Pilate more afraid. Pilate was afraid, and it made him more afraid. So for the second time, he pulls Jesus to the side and he interrogates him. And he asks him an incredible question. He says, "Where are you from?" Not like, "Hey, where are you from? What town did you grow up in?" It's not that kind of question. "Where are you from?" Jesus gave no answer. And then Pilate gets upset with him and says, "You don't answer me? I have the power to release you or crucify you." And Jesus tells him, almost in a comforting way, "You would have no power unless it was given to you from above. The ones who have delivered me to you, they have the greater sin." So Pilate takes Jesus back out, seeking a way to release him. And Pilate brings up the prisoner release again, but instead the people say, "We want Barabbas released." Barabbas was a criminal. He was a robber who had been caught up in an insurrection and had murdered, and he was condemned to die. A thief and murderer, or Jesus. And the crowd picked Barabbas. Pilate answered, "Well, why? What crime has he committed?" Speaking of Jesus. And they pushed the hot button. They said, "He makes himself out to be a king, and you are no friend of Caesar if you release him." That was it. That was it. He made one more gesture, trying to get them to back off. "Behold your king." And they wanted him crucified. So Pilate called for a basin of water. He rinsed his hands symbolically and said, "I am innocent of this man's blood. I'm innocent of this man's blood." And the crowd instinctively called out, "May his blood be on us and our children." Unwittingly, they said the right thing. Because it's only the blood of Jesus that can save. And then we're told that Pilate gave the order to have him crucified. We've been looking this year at Jesus. We wish to see Jesus. And we've seen a lot today. We've seen enough to make us think. Next week we'll look at the crucifixion. And we've also seen enough, haven't we, to remember as we should his body and his blood. Ray has a final song for us to sing. When you look at the last hours of that Thursday and the early hours of that Friday, some people would not see someone they'd want to follow. They see a Jesus that's weak, that's defeated, that appears to be helpless. But that's not who he is. His strength was in his composure and his restraint, in the tenderness that he showed from washing the disciples' feet to restoring Malchus's ear. Shows a kindness at a moment where one is going through so much that is unbelievable. The way that the accusations bounced off of him was proof of his pristine character. And the fact that he was allowing this suffering to be a payment for our sins shows that his love is true and greater than any. And so one can become a follower of Christ any hour of the day or night. But as we're closing our assembly today, we sing this song to provide opportunity for one who wants to come to Christ and be baptized into him and become his follower. If you desire that, you can do so as we stand and sing.